we'll get started in a moment. So this will be a discussion section on, I don't remember what the formal title was, something like fractionalization and topological defects in Cornerstone Hall and topological insulator. So we have a number of speakers who have graciously offered proof of for not particularly good reasons, organize them in this order. So we'll hear about a number of different topics. Sort of perhaps the most directly related to the main subject of the workshop will be a couple of talks describing ways to probe fractional quantum numbers or fractionalization of some type in quantum spin ball and topological insulators. I hope that these will give us some suggestions and ideas for possible future avenues of experiments we might talk about. Some of the issues we might be able to discuss are, in what sense are these things really fractionalization in the same sense that we know it occurs in, for instance, fractional quantum Hall systems? Are they different? So two of the talks kind of directly related to that, and will be the first talk by Chi, and then the last talk by Vishwanath, or possibly by Yun Ran, if Ashwin doesn't make it here in time. He's riding down from Berkeley this morning. Then we'll, the other talks will be a bit more in the spirit of generalizations. Gabby Callen will be telling us something about ways of combining ideas of quantum spin Hall and perhaps topological or exotic ordering interacting electron or spin systems. Hatsugai will be telling us kind of more general ideas of how to apply C2 or Derrick phase ideas to fractionalization and other sorts of systems like spin systems, for instance. And Yuval, I don't quite know what he's talking about, but the title was fractionalization and the integer quantum Hall effect. So another related but general topic. Then we'll come back to Ashwin, who, as I said, is kind of, it will take us full circle. So please, it should be about 20 minutes each, and we'll have a lot of discussion.
Thank you. Thanks, Leo. I'm very glad to be here to have this opportunity to talk about our work last year. So it's about two fractionalization phenomena in quantum spin Hall effect. In quantum spin Hall insulators, there are the fractional charge on the boundary and the spin charge separation in the bulk. And this work is in collaboration with Taylor and Taylor Hughes and Professor Sheng Zhang, and with these two papers. So here is the outline. And for the fractional charge effect, we are discussing about a fractional charge induced by a magnetic domain wall on the quantum spin Hall edge, which you already heard briefly from Xiao Cheng's talk. And I will talk about why this is a unique phenomenon for quantum spin Hall, and how to relate this to the bulk effect theory rather than only edge theory, and what's the experimental proposals. And then for the spin charge separation, I will talk about similar things, which is, so what's the phenomena? The spin charge separation in a flux tube threaded into the quantum spin Hall insulator, and why it's a unique phenomena which only occurs in the quantum spin Hall insulator. And then, so we have some general conclusions about this spin charge separation and the experimental proposals. So I don't need to introduce much about quantum spin Hall. Just briefly remind everyone. So the quantum spin Hall, the simplest way to understand it is it's a quantum Hall effect with Hall conductance opposite for spin up and down, and then you consider turn on spin up couplings, anything which doesn't break time reversal symmetry between these two layers, and then you get you go beyond with this bilayer quantum Hall limit, but you are still in a topological state, as first shown by Charlie Kane and Millie's work, and This is first related to the quantum anomalous Hall effect, which it means you can have a quantum Hall in a band insulator. And then start from that, if you take two layers, that means you can get a quantum spin Hall effect also in a band insulator without T breaking. And then So Andrew Taylor and Xiao Cheng predict this effect in mercury telluride and realized by Lawrence group 1 year later. So then the thing we will use in my talk is the edge states. So the edge state of quantum spin Hall effect is counter-propagating with spin up propagate on one direction and spin down on the opposite direction, and they are time reversal planars. And the key reason why it's topological non-trivial is that they are time reversal planars. So this crossing at k equal to 0 or pi is stable, and any perturbation which doesn't break time reversal won't leave the degeneracy, because to leave the degeneracy you have to break time reversal to choose some spin of your occupied state. So then why it lead to a fractional charge effect? So that can be understood easily by compare with the 1D chain described by Sussman-Schreiber-Higgins model. So if we consider a 1D spinless fermion chain, and you have this kind of dispersion, and this is minus KF and KF. And then if you have a CDW, then that lead to scattering from this KF to minus KF. That lead to a CDW order. And in that sense, your brain zone was folded due to this translation symmetry breaking. Then this dispersion looks exactly like quantum spin Hall edge. You have one left mover, one right mover. So in that sense, we know in Sussman-Schreiber-Higgins model, if you have a domain wall of the CDW, then you get a half charge on the domain wall. And in the same way, we will get a domain, half charge on the domain wall on a quantum spin Hall edge if you have a T-breaking term. So let's compare more carefully. So in the Sussman-Schreiber-Higgins chain like this, then there are two possible mass terms. One is the bound CDW, which means strong weak bonds, and one is the set CDW. And you have a lower energy here, higher. And this corresponds to two mass terms. And in the same way, in the quantum spin Hall edge, you have also two mass terms, which correspond both to some magnetization or magnetic field. And that's because, as we said, without breaking time reversal, it's not possible to open a gap. So that means both mass term is induced by magnetic field. And so in the CDW case, if you have a domain wall between strong weak and weak strong, you get a half charge. And in the quantum spin Hall case, you get a half charge if you have a domain wall with opposite magnetic field. So then it's natural to ask this question. So why half is special? So it seems that I get half just because I take an anti-parallel magnetic field. And if you take any other angle of magnetic field, on the domain wall, my magnetic field rotate by 30 degree, then you can get any fractional charge. But but the half is special in the sense that, if I say my magnetic field rotate by 30 degree and then I get a charge of E over 12, something like that, that's not stable. That can change to any value due to the details of what's the mass induced by the magnetic field, because that can depend on details. But what doesn't depend on the detail is opposite magnetic field always induce opposite mass, and that's required by time reversal symmetry, because the mass term is time reversal odd, magnetic field is also. So that means if your magnetic field if it's an anti-phase domain wall, means magnetic field change oppositely, like here is B, here is minus B. In that case, you know for sure that the mass also change sign across the domain wall, and that always lead to a half charge on the domain wall. So that's why this phenomena has an intrinsic relation to the quantum spin Hall effect, because I have a time reversal symmetry, I have a time reversal invariant system, and I break time reversal on the boundary, but if I break time reversal in opposite way, and then on the domain wall, I have a half charge. In this way, it's robust and doesn't depend on the details of the system.
Michael, time reversal symmetry transformation is I also symmetry sign.
I'm sorry?
So when you do time reversal, the M1 plus I, M2,
yeah.
I also switch a sign. It means that M1 is even or M2 is M1 is odd, M2 is even.
That's not the case exactly, because T squared is minus 1. So when you do time reversal, if you only do conjugate, then it's true, one is even, one is odd. But you need to flip the spin. So you know when you flip the spin, all the three matrices are odd.
So M1 is
coupled to sigma 1, M2 are coupled to sigma 2, they are both odd. And that's very essential for protecting constraint Gaussian.
It's kind of funny that there are only two components of the mass and three components of the magnetic field.
Exactly.
The direction in which you get the field and you get no mass.
Yes. So the mass in general can be a complex function of the magnetic field. What you know is it's all the function. And if you expand to the linear order, then you get mass equal to some 2 by 3 matrix times the magnetic field. That means there will be one direction which doesn't give you mass. And what's that? The magnetic field along that direction just shift this crossing to some direction.
It depends on there being some direction that the state is spin polarized along.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
That doesn't in general have to be true, right?
So that's true in the linear order. If you expand the mass as a function of magnetic field, then in general you have some vector, like I have two mass. And
the block state along the boundary is some superposition of things that differ by a reciprocal lattice vector. Or if you like in real sense,
the state
doesn't have to have direction.
Exactly. So that's the case. So let's say, so when you consider the case when it's just decoupled to copies of quantum Hall, so this is well defined, just spin up, this is just spin down, then in that case you really have a direction which is the z direction, and that magnetic field will just shift like this and without opening a gap. But in general case, your spin is rotating like this.
In any particular case,
it has a fixed direction.
For a general block state, in any particular case, a block state.
Yeah, you're right. So
superposition different plane waves, and each plane wave can have a different spin to be running.
That's right. So what Joe means is when you look at the wave function of the edge states, like this is my edge, this is the other direction. As in the real space, it's like my spin is doing this, and it can rotate. So that means I don't have a particular direction in this way. But if you study the symmetry, I take these two states and calculate I have a magnetic field term in my Hamiltonian and calculate K up and not up but K left mover, K right mover. You calculate the matrix element, I think there will always be some directional magnetic field which give you zero. But for a finite magnetic field, I think this is only true when you consider the linear order of a magnetic field. I think if you apply a finite magnetic field in general, you can always open a gap.
That's a strong statement, the one on top, that's saying that for any block state, there's some field direction.
Which doesn't mix them. I think that's true.
If this is still true, when you consider disorder, you might think that in different regions of the edge, it's a different
exactly.
Polarization axis.
Yeah. I think when you have disorder, then in general, you always open a gap with any T-breaking. Yeah. But our argument is still correct because we want to open the gap. That's what we want. We want to open a gap. So, yeah.
So, but when you have disorder, then you have to really talk about that it's the change in the charge between having everything pointing the same direction and then switching half of it, right?
Yeah, so you have to talk about the exact statement will be a domain wall between some magnetic field configuration and its exact time reversal pattern.
No, but it's not, you can't just look at the domain wall by itself, you have to compare it to not having the domain wall there, right? You have to look at the difference of the charge.
Yeah, because you mean local, because I can have some trivial reason here, I just have some charge there.
Right.
That's right, but that charge won't be half.
Right, so you have to
take the compare.
The thing which is a half is not the charge, it's the difference in the charge.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the charge pumped through.
Pumped through when you flip a magnetic domain wall. And that's exactly the key thing, how can we get an experimental proposal in that you need to compare. Yeah. Okay, so I will say, so in summary, so what I want to say here is it's not only a realization of half charge, it gives you a way to detect the quantum spin Hall system or define the quantum spin Hall system in an observable way, because we cannot say spin Hall conductance because spin is not conserved. But if I consider my magnetic domain wall as an external field, although the magnetic domain wall itself breaks time reversal, but it's an external field which you use to detect your time reversal environment system. And then I say, what do I measure? And I measure the charge on the domain wall, and you always get half or zero, modulo one. So that's, in that sense, it's a you get a quantized number, and that's the quantized response of quantum Sleeping Hall system.
Sorry, this is probably a very silly question. So this is, let's say, one value of the charge. Now you compare it with this.
Yeah.
That's 1/2.
Yeah.
And if you compare it with the time reverse, you get 1, right?
Yes.
So the difference between two time reverse configurations is 1, and not 1/2.
Yeah, so the difference between domain wall and no domain wall is 1/2, yeah.
Yes, I thought that no domain wall was something kind of vague, something which was not intrinsically defined.
No, it's not vague. The definition is... when we talk about domain wall, we don't care the details on the domain wall. We only concern the asymptotic behavior of its left and right. So the case with anti-phase domain wall is defined as, I don't know what happens here as the domain wall, and the only thing I care is when I go to left, far away left, I get something like this. Far away right, I get something like that. And I require this when you take time reversal, it becomes that. That's the definition of domain wall. And no domain wall can be defined the same
way. Time reversal on the left and the right, you can only do time reversal. You have to compare time reversal on, you have to start with everything up and then time reverse half of it, right?
Yeah, that's equivalent to this, right? If you can take time reversal on half of them, then you can, somehow you define the local time reversal operation.
No, but yeah, I guess what I'm saying is the thing on the right is not the time reverse of the thing that's on the left. The thing that's on the right is the time reverse of what it was before.
I think.
Right. If you have disorder, the field that you fly on the right might not be in the same direction. You know, might not be opposite.
That is right. But when we work out this bulk topological field theory and try to see in what so how do we understand this half charge in the bulk? Then I think the condition we found there is you require this and this locally. I mean, if I look locally in this region, it looks like a translating invariant system. And if I look at here, it looks like a translating invariant system. And only when they are time reversal partners, then I get half charge. So I think it's like when you consider a domain wall, then you get half charge when you have a phase change of pi. And that you can you always need to compare this and that. You cannot just compare this with itself. But it's true that they may be equivalent. I mean, if you compare this with itself, then you think about time direction, and you change this from no domain wall and with a domain wall, and then you pump half charge. I think that's true in that sense. Yeah. Okay. So I will say only one slide about the bulk theory. So we can because on edge theory everything is clear, but edge theory only works when you take the Lorentz limit. So it's in principle it's possible that when you go to the lattice when you go to the lattice theory, you can get some modification of your charge. So to make sure that then we later have another paper about the bulk effective theory, then where there you can see it's robust because it corresponds to some topological invariant in the bulk. And we can see that in the Dirac model case. So if your bulk quantum Sleeping Hall effect is described by a 4x4 Dirac model, and as shown in Andrew's Taylor and Sochang's paper, and then in that Dirac model, if you require time reversal invariants, then you have only one possible mass term, and that mass change sign from quantum Sleeping Hall to the vacuum. But if you allow time reversal symmetry breaking, and then you have another two mass terms, and so in total you have three mass terms which give you a vector. And that vector on the north pole tell you it's vacuum, on the south pole tell you it's quantum Sleeping Hall. But when you interpolate between them, other points are time reversal breaking. So then the half charge is carried by a Meron of such an order parameter. Because when you have the interface between them, then it corresponds to a vector lies in the plane. Because that breaks T. It's like a gamma 5 mass. So and then you get a Meron. In that sense, we know we have a general formula telling you there is a half charge here wherever you have a Meron. And that's like a 2D generalization of the Goldstone-Wilczek formula. Okay, so then I will go to the experimental proposal. So Shoucheng also talked about this briefly in his talk. So the idea is we use some to detect the half charge, There is a technique which is suitable for this, which is the single electron transistor. So basically, if you have a quantum dot, then in general, you hop an electron onto the quantum dot, you need to cost quantum energy. And then you will get an exponentially small conductance because you need to overcome the gap. But there is a special case where you don't need to cost the quantum energy. That's when you put a gate to screen the charge on the quantum dot, and the charge on the quantum dot is always integer, but your background screening charge can be anything. So you tune your gate voltage, and you can get the net charge on the quantum dot to be half. And if it's minus half, then you turn a charge on it, and it becomes plus half, and the quantum energy is the same. So in that case, the charge can the electron can hop here and here without overcoming this Coulomb gap. So that's what lead to this Coulomb blockade phenomena. And means when you tune the background gate voltage, you will get oscillations in the conductance, and the oscillation peaks correspond to where you have a net charge on the Coulomb dot, which is half. And we use that in the quantum spin Hall case. And it turns out that you cannot just use another like single electron transistor to measure the half charge, because in that case you will have all these problems of screenings. Like you have a half charge here, but it can be screened by other things, and in that way you cannot detect the exact half. And just like Charlie said, you need to compare the case with and without domain wall. So in that case, the idea is we create a single electron transistor on the edge of quantum spin hall. So you put it, because we have said that once you have a T breaking, then that can give you a mass term, which means that lead to backscattering, and they play the role of a potential on the edge states. So if I put the two magnetic islands on top, then that can induce a double barrier geometry. I mean, my edge is a one-dimensional system, and now there are double barriers. And then if they are close by, then I effectively trap a quantum dot between them. So now I can tune the gate voltage and measure the Coulomb blockade effect. And I know the peak happens when you have a net charge is half. But then when I flip one of the magnetization, then compare these two configurations, I have one additional charge, half here. It may be half or minus half, but it's half plus an integer. So in that case, you compare this pattern conductance, this conductance oscillation here and here, it will shift by a half. And that's because when you flip the magnetic field, in principle, you are not expecting any other change, and the only change it induced is this due to this topological effect. You pump a half charge inside. So then, in this way, you can just by compare these two patterns, you can subtract all trivial effects and detect the half charge. And more generally, if in principle, if you can rotate the magnetic field continuously, then you will see the peak position shift by a period after you go back. That's also one way to detect its topological non-trivial. So just briefly about the experimental conditions. So when you apply the magnetic field, then one Tesla will give you like 3 MeV. And then we estimate what's the size of the magnetic island, which is good for realization of this proposal. And that seems reasonable in the range of the nano quantum, magnetic islands where you can put on the surface. Or we can, alternatively, we can also put a supernova on the surface and use the flux to generate the magnetic field, which may have a larger, maybe it can generate a larger magnetic field. So this is the first part. Sorry, how long time do I have? So I will be. I'll try to finish it quickly. And this second part is about another topological phenomena, which is in a bulk. So means if you thread a pi flux tube in the quantum spin Hall insulator, then that lead to a spin charge separation. So we have for a similar proposal. Ying and Ashwin and Dong Hai also have this paper on PIL. So let's start from the.
So actually, Liang and I had a similar proposal in a cylinder geometry.
The spin charge separation.
So if you thread a half a flux through a cylinder.
And you pump a Z2.
You pump a spin to the end of the cylinder, which is really the same the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the key point of our paper is, as I will show later, I would say it's a follow-up of your flux threading, the Z2 pumping, and also Joe and I think has a paper which talk about combined the spin flux and charge flux, and we use this concept and formulate it in a many body way to show it really doesn't depend on any detail, and this spin charge separation is really intrinsic. So let's start from the Kolmogorov case. So we know in the Kolmogorov, when you thread, it's basically a Laughlin argument, gauge argument. When you thread a flux, you generate a tangential electric field, and that pumping a longitudinal current inside or outside. And the charge proportional to the flux you thread. So if you thread a pi flux, you get a half charge. And this is easy to understand. So then we start from the simplest quantum spin Hall insulator, which is just decoupled two copies of the quantum Hall with opposite Hall conductance. So this is a sample with the quantum spin Hall, and I draw spin up and down with two layers, although they are spatially at the same position. So now when you thread a flux, and the blue and red means my spin up and down electrons see the same flux. And then you generate an electric field, and because the spin up and down layer has opposite Hall conductance, so spin up electron will move outside. So these points, I mean, something like a one-year function. So you can think of it as the local orbitals. And we apply an electric field, and due to the Hall effect, everything moves outside. But the spin down electron move oppositely. So that means the total charge pumped around the flux field is zero, but there is a spin, and you get a spin 1/2, because you pump a spin 1/4 for the spin up, and a spin minus 1/4 for, 1/4 for spin down, and they sum together to give you spin 1/2. And that's when you thread a normal charge flux, which means the electromagnetic flux, and that gives you no charge, half spin. And in the same way, if you thread the opposite flux, which we can understand when you have decoupled two layers, and then both layers pump charge in the same way, and opposite spin. So in that sense, you will get a net charge of E pumped in the vertex core, and a spin zero. So in that sense, we can simply look at the quantum numbers and get the conclusion that the flux tube carry a quantum number of a spin charge separated object. It's just like in the 1D polyacetylene, you do the same counting. And the next thing is, the important thing is, these two flux configurations I draw by up and down arrows, they are actually the same flux. And because pi flux doesn't matter whether it's up or down. But these two just are different process to go to the same final state. And they give you two different states. So why it's unique for quantum spin Hall? So So in general, if you break spin rotation symmetry, then you don't know how to define the spin charge separation. But if you have time reversal symmetry, you can still define spin charge separation, because I can say what is a spin on. I can say spin on is something with no charge, but spin 1/2. But spin 1/2 is defined by it's a time reversal, it's a Kramer's doublet. So in summary, a conventional electron system is defined satisfy this equation. You take time reversal T square, and it's minus 1 for each electron. So for a many-body system, it's minus 1 over NF. If you have all the number of electrons, it's Kramer's doublet. But a spin charge separated system means if I have a flux threaded in the quantum spin Hall system, and the other flux is far away, and I only look at the local neighborhood of this flux, and then you take imagine I don't know the other flux, and I study the time reversal property of this local part of the system, then you see T square is minus of minus 1F, which means if there is no charge, then you see T square is minus 1, that's a spin on. And if you have one charge, then T square is plus 1, tells you it has charge but no spin. And from this, you can also understand why it's stable, because once it's there, then you can add any electrons on it, and it always flip this side and this side at the same time, and it won't violate this equation. So I will briefly go through the general arguments. So the interesting thing is, so following this, here, since we understand that we understand that it's generally we can define the grammar, the spin charge separation, then we can also show it's true that in general quantum spin house system, we still have this phenomenon, although the spin up and down are not decoupled. So this is done by rather general flux, which can be any spin direction, and you can show that. So basically, we have two conclusions, and first is any time when you thread a spin flux, you will pump an integer charge, and that tells you it's always integer. And the reason is you can thread a pi flux and remove the flux in the charge channel, and that closes the loop and always pump integer charge. And also, the parity of that charge doesn't depend on which spin direction you use your spin flux, and that's what makes it Z2 quantity. So if you thread a flux in the SZ, then you get you pump a charge 1. Then you thread a flux in SX, maybe you pump a charge -1, but they are both odd. So we also show that in the numerical calculations. And so the experimental proposal is experimentally, if you put a flux, then at break time reversal, and you split the degeneracy of the two spin-ons. So in that way, you can scan your gate voltage to tune your state in the charging or spin-on state. And so you can detect spin and charge separately. And that's all, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So, I mean, this last thing that you said about the generalization for the many-body case, that depends crucially on the fact that when you insert this spin flux in a more general sense, where there is no well-defined spin,
yeah,
Hamiltonian has to be entirely gapped, and that's not entirely clear how you can do that for an arbitrary.
That's true. Yeah.
Especially because you're introducing all the flux through one set of bonds, which cut through the entire system. So it's not clear whether it's very different from the quantum Hall case, because in the quantum Hall case you can spread that around.
Yeah, because when you break spin rotation symmetry, and then when you thread a spin flux, you can in general you break the translation symmetry. So you have, as you said, you are threading a flux by introducing some string. We are making a clear statement that basically when you thread such a flux, there are two possibilities. One is you close the gap. One is you happen to don't close, you didn't close the gap, and the statement is whenever your gap remains finite, you will pump a charge with fixed parity.
Yeah. Okay.
So you draw a parameter space, and there are some points which is gapless. But as long as there are some directions which remains the gap finite, then you get the same parity of charge pumped.
What I'd like to make is that it follows, at least in the case where you have a Hamiltonian which separates as H1 plus H2 at the time, it follows from my formula where I've written the Z2 in terms of the Chern number that you will have.
In that case, we know from Kong Hao, yes.
Yes, but then the other argument for the adiabatic continuity is the one which is, I guess, the same thing that preserves the Kramer's doublet at the edge. It's the same argument.
Sure, yeah. And physically, of course, that's the same argument. But I want to emphasize that we are not using the adiabatic continuity from our system to a decoupled two-couple Kong Hall system. We are using the adiabatic adiabaticity when you thread a flux. Yeah.
You're using adiabatic continuity when you thread a flux, which is adiabatically continued to this argument, I guess.
So. Okay.
Charles?
So would you say that there's fractional charge in the integer quantum Hall effect?
When you thread a pi flux.
What about when you thread, you know, a irrational flux?
I understand. Yeah. So that's the question when I talk about fractional charge on the domain wall. You say, how about you just have some different angle of domain wall, then you can get any half charge.
There's something. You see, in the integer quantum Hall effect, there are no excitations of the Hamiltonian with fractional charge. But if you thread a flux through a hole, you can
get any charge.
Bring
yes.
a fractional charge in here. So I think the same thing is true in the quantum spin Hall effect, that there are no excitations with there's nothing.
That's true.
It's not fractionalized the way the fractional.
Well, we can consider the case of fractional charge at the edge.
So you can imagine that we don't impose any external magnetic domain on the edge. The through time fraction time reversal is
spontaneous.
Right, but that's a different state.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a different
so,
state.
So
that's
let's
like
just.
The trigger here.
Yeah.
So the, I agree with the fractionalization there.
But will not give you a fractional charge. It will give you spin charge separation.
I understand, but yeah. So
yeah. So I think
that's a different state. That's a state of the edge, not a state of the bulk.
Right.
So
I think the statement here is that of course quantum spin-Hall is quantum spin-Hall can be realized in a band insulator without interaction. So in the regular sense, in the whether you have a spin charge separated excitation of the system, the answer is of course you can't.
So I think it's a little bit misleading to call this fractionalization because that sounds like it's like the fractional, you know, like it's.
Then let me put it in this way. So the statement is quantum spin-Hall can translate a conventional flux liquid or a vortex liquid to spin charge separated liquid. And the key thing in this statement is if.
Wait, how do you get a spin charge separated liquid?
What? I mean, if you start from a normal, let's say, if you start from a case where you have this pi flux moving around, and they are, like, for example, in the Z2 gauge theory. And you have this pi flux moving around,
but they are not spin charge separated. Dynamical degree of freedom.
Yeah. So that part is not the quantum spin-Hall. That part is not given by the quantum spin-Hall. But the statement is, whenever you have such a flux liquid, which is not spin charge separated, quantum spin-Hall, you couple quantum spin-Hall to the system, it translated into a spin charge separated.
I agree. So
system.
If you promote the flux to being an excitation of the system.
So it's like in the one.
Something you can do by considering a hybrid. System of superconductor and
So let's
using the proximity effect, just using the spontaneous in the cosmic solid space.
The key thing is if you have a flux liquid if you have a flux liquid that's not a spin charge separated, and when you couple it to quantum spin-Hall won't give you quantum spin-Hall on one hand it gives you spin charge separated object, it drags every flux tube to a spin charge separated object. On the other hand, it doesn't give you a divergent energy of that. So in the same sense, if you couple such a flux liquid to quantum Hall, then I give you half charge liquid. That's true.
What's the spin charge separation? You compare the standard one-dimensional spin charge separation. Well, is there any the same thing or they are fundamental difference?
About the 1D one?
The matching liquid.
Yeah, that's also another interesting thing. So you look at the 1D case. It's I mean they are in the sense that. It's a spin charge separated. It's a spin charge separation carried by some topological defect. So they are similar, but in 2D, I mean, you need a flux and a quantum spin Hall to realize it. In 1D, you need a domain wall. I mean, they are.
What
yeah.
do you told me? The ordinary
Lattice
liquid has a spin charge separation.
Yeah. You mean the
ordinary. Any one-dimensional interacting, half of them say one-dimensional.
I think I can understand that one also in this way, right? I can understand it as some solitons which carry spin charge separate. Yeah. So that soliton plays the same role as that soliton is like polyacetylene soliton. Yeah.
Just have a comment and following Charles' comment. I think it's a when people talk about fractionalization, people really mean there's a fractionalized excitation. So I think for this pi flux thing, I mean, because our paper is also mentioned, so I want to mention that. So we did that part. So we.
Yeah, you cover the
quantum spin-Hall. They function as a mean field state of a strongly correlated system where you can view this electron as a spin-on coupled to an emergent Z2 gauge field. And then there you have this dynamical pi flux excitation, which can hop around and have statistics and so on. So that's the purpose of our paper.
Yeah, I think the point is that this gives you a general and physically measurable definition of the Z2 quantum. So that any insulator you have, two-dimensional insulator, time reverse invariant, you insert a pi flux, which does not break time reverse symmetry, and you ask yourself around in these pipelines.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Whether you have spin charge separation or not. And that's
but no, wait, no, not spin charge separation, okay. Whether or not.
Yeah,
but whether.
I agree. If you do something.
You invert the pipelines, and you can do that to a system which has very strong interaction, very lot of disorder. The moment you insert the flux, you can ask. Basically, in another way of saying the Z2 is it's an anonymous representation of time reversal symmetry. Like conventional representation of time reversal symmetry, if I have even number, I have a frame of single. I have odd number, I have frame of double. But near the pi flux of Z2 insulator, it's exactly the opposite thing that happens.
Yeah.
So that gives you a physically measurable flow to define what.
So the way we formulated it in our bumping thing was as a Laughlin argument, where you have a cylinder, and you know, in an ordinary insulator, if you thread flux through a cylinder, then since everything's localized, nothing can happen. But in the quantum spin Hall insulator, when you thread the flux through the cylinder, then you pump a spin a half to the end. Okay, and so something changes, and that's the physically measurable consequence, which is transcends whether you're.
I think that.
But I wouldn't call that spin charge separation.
Yeah, but I think that is well defined when the cylinder is large. If the cylinder is finite, then one needs to close the cycle and have a well defined amount of charging.
No, there's no charge.
You're applying a pi flux.
And it's three flux.
No. I'm applying charge flux.
So I think what Joel wants to say is.
Charge flux means a magnetic field through the.
Half integer spin. So the question is whether at the end is there a Cramer's degeneracy or not?
It's basically
why you're motivated to worry about closing the cycle and being able to compare a system to itself. Is that I think for a finite system you have to do that, and I'm happy to explain in more detail about this.
It's also one motivation is so you have the Z2 pumping, but I don't know how to define time reversal locally. So one way to do that is I do reversely. I thread spin flux and pump charge, and charge is well defined. You thread a flux and pump spin, right?
Yeah.
And we know it's correspond to. Switch partner and lead to pump half spin from this side to that side. But a spin is not a good one. I don't know how to write down.
Is there a Cramer's degeneracy or not? That's a well-defined
edge. I mean, the system is not a clear, but.
just try to do the.
But if there's a gap, then if there's a degeneracy, you can associate that with one.
That's fine in a large enough system.
Yeah.
I think one.
It's finite in this direction, but it's very, very long in the.
That's right, but I should be able to define that there's a vector space, even if it's not infinite in that one direction. By integer quantum bulk pumping for a system, it's a finite torus in both directions, right?
But it has to be longer than the magnetic lines, right?
I agree. I think it's only well defined when the other one is very far away. Otherwise, I think we can discuss later. Sorry.
I think we ought to move on to make sure we have time for the other speakers.
But I agree.
How
logical
in the response function. Let's thank our first speaker. I did ask all contributors to try and pose a question at the end of their talks. I haven't heard a single one yet, I think. We had a lot of questions during the talk.
So I would say, what's quantized thing, quantum thing called? Experimentally measured quantum.
I would pose a similar question. What is the actual experiment that you're threading a flux through a cylinder is not going to happen too quickly.
Solar lights require any different.
Anyone here familiar with an Apple on the system?
Close your Mac.
Just close it, okay.
Close it. Detach it, hook it on.
Yeah, I tried my system preferences.
You did detect displays?
Yeah. Oh, just wait. Oh, it's doing something. Great, thank you. So I'm going to talk about a quantum spin-on Hall effect. So I think this is a real fractionalized system compared to in the context of the last discussion, but it may not be a real physical system. It's a toy model. But in this case, we're going to look at a quantum spin Hall effect where spin-ons carry the spin current at the edge of the system. And this is work done with Sung-Sik Lee at McMaster and our student Michael Young. And Sung-Sik Lee, who's here, is a real expert on this. But I guess we'll hear from him on a different topic tomorrow. I'll try and keep this brief, just a little bit about the motivation and model, a few comments on the method, and then the key results, one experimental signature, and then I'll discuss the stability and possible future directions. So we heard from Charlie Kane on Monday how graphene or the honeycomb lattice with spin orbit interaction supports the quantum spin Hall effect, which gives these topological edge states that are protected by time reversal symmetry and a special band structure arising from the spin orbit coupling, and the system has a gap in the bulk. We also know from work of Sung-Sik Lee and Patrick Lee that the Hubbard model on a honeycomb lattice may support a U1 spin liquid near the metal insulator transition. So this is a phase where the charge modes are gapped, but there's gapless direct spin-ons in the bulk, and there's an emergent U1 gauge theory. So the purpose of this work is to explore the possibility of having the quantum spin Hall effect rising simultaneously with this type of fractionalization. And the first problem you encounter is that the quantum spin Hall effect requires a gap in the bulk, whereas the U1 fractionalization has gapless excitations in the bulk. And so this naturally points towards, or at least points towards looking at a bilayer system to get around this problem. And at this point, I should say that this is just, this is a toy model. It's sort of the simplest model we could think of that would allow us to study the interplay of these two phenomena. So we have electrons hopping on a honeycomb lattice, a honeycomb bilayer. Each layer is at half filling, so there's the usual nearest neighbor hopping term. And then just on the first layer, there's a second neighbor hopping, which is, you know, angle and spin dependent. This comes from the spin orbit coupling, and this is what's going to give you the special band structure that gives you the quantum spin Hall effect. In addition, the electrons interact through just an on-site Hubbard in both layers, and then the two layers also interact through this nearest neighbor Hubbard interaction or Coulomb interaction. So following the work of
the electrons are not tunnelable.
There's no tunneling, yeah, and that's actually important. We'll see where that comes in. There's the two layers are coupled only through a Coulomb interaction, and we follow you know, the method of Lee and Lee for the U1 spin liquid, treating this Hamiltonian in mean field theory and decomposing the electron operator into a fermion spin-on operator and a bosonic charge-on operator. We also actually only look at this model near a special point of U prime equals to you. And the significance of that is, if you look at these terms at that point, this only depends on the sum of n1 plus n2 on each site and not on the difference. And since the phase of the charge on operator is conjugate to the density, when one looks at this, you find that the charge on phase in the two layers is coupled or tied together such that you only have a single charge on phase in this problem. And it also results from this. This is, you know, there's one charge on phase, the difference that is condensed, and so the gauge field that couples to that through the Higgs mechanism is gapped. So we end up with a single charge on phase and a single U1 gauge that operates over both layers. And then we just, you know, we follow a standard mean field where we decouple our quartic hopping terms by introducing these bond variables. And so if you think about a small u, that's the limit where the layers are decoupled and each layer is weakly interacting. So for example, in the second layer, that's just your pristine graphene where you just expect the four Dirac fermions or semi-metal. In layer one, because we have the second neighbor spin orbit hopping, you get the conventional quantum spin Hall effect. And both these states are, that's a uniform solution. On the other hand, if you go to large U, well, typically in the Hubbard model, you expect either antiferromagnetism or some kind of dimerized valence bond state. It turns out these are degenerate for the honeycomb lattice, and because we actually have a higher symmetry here because of our layer index, that should actually favor singlet formation and hence favor the valence bond solution. So we look for dimerized solutions, and these are sort of the two onslaughts we look within mean field theory of uniform and dimerized phases.
Is it an exciton condensate in the charge section? Do you have a Goldstone node?
You mean from the relative phase dropping out?
What's
the dynamics of it? I mean, it's you know, for right at that special point, right, it just locks the things at theta 1 equals theta 2. I don't know, are there any low-lying excitations? I mean, the U1 is gapped.
Of course, there's an antisymmetric gauge field. It's fixed.
Well, that's where the gauge is. The gauge field is gapped.
Antisymmetric combination of charge excitation, gauge fields are gapped. So there are initially two gauge fields and two boson fields, and antisymmetric combination exciton condenses, and then the antisymmetric gauge field is.
Okay. Okay, so looking over these two onslaughts, this is the phase diagram we find T primed versus U, where, as I said, for the small u, we just get the two decoupled layers with a conventional quantum spin Hall and a semi-metal in the other layer. At large u, we find an insulating phase that's dimerized. And near the metal insulator transition, there's a region here, as long as T and U is sufficiently large, where this new phase emerges. And the properties of this phase are, remember, we only have a single charge on field and U1 gauge field operating over both layers. The charge ons are gapped, so it's electrically insulating. And there's a massless U1 gauge field. If we look at the second layer, first of all, the second layer basically just looks like the Li and Li spin liquid. So you have Dirac, there's four Dirac spin-ons in the bulk. Whereas if you look at the first layer, the spin-ons are gapped in the bulk with the Kane-Mallet spectrum, but there's gapless spin-on edge modes. And to see that, I just pulled out one of our terms in our mean field Hamiltonian. Remember, these are the spin-on operators, and you see, you know, they just they have the usual first neighbor hopping, and this is the second neighbor hopping with these phases. You know, all that happened in the mean field is you have a renormalized hopping parameter. It's this T primed here with the phases that set the special band structure, and that's inherited by the spin-ons. So the spin-ons are acting, are just playing the same role as electrons in the Kane-Mallet work on the honeycomb.
So is edge mode stable against the bulk gate field fluctuation?
Yeah, well, that's an important point. Yeah, and I'll get to that just after this transparency. So first, I just want to make the point that the state is different. You know, the fact that your edge modes are spin-ons, and to see this, one can think of the Laughlin experiment that was just mentioned a minute ago. If for the usual quantum spin Hall system, if you put your system in the topology of a cylinder, adiabatically thread a flux quantum through, then we know, you know, a spin up moves in one direction, spin down moves in the opposite direction, so that there's no charge transport, but you've transported a spin one across your system. In our case, the spin-ons are neutral, so they don't couple to the electromagnetic flux. And at zero temperature, there's absolutely no transport here. So that's a key difference. One indication that the state is really different.
Is that in your second layer? Sorry, your two layers.
It's the whole system combined. And if you're worried about the coupling, through the U1 gauge field to the to the charge ones at t equals zero, that's protected too. So there's absolutely no transport at t equals zero. That is, the internal gauge has to, stay fixed. Okay, someone mentioned, so we found in this toy model, we found a region of phase space where mean field theory picks out the solution. Of course, we have to ask, is this solution self-consistent and stable, because we have a lot of low-lying excitations, and could those actually destroy these edge states? So there's a number of things one has to consider here. And first is our U1 gauge theory is compact, so we know we have to worry about instantons, which are known to destroy fractionalization. First of all, in our problem, we actually conserve SZ, and so in this case, actually, you can't have instantons. But even if we relax that condition and generalize our model such that we didn't conserve SC, there's work by Hermeli et al. Showing that in the large N limit for N flavors of Dirac fermions, that these suppress instantons. And of course, the question then becomes, is N equals 4, is that big enough? That's a numerical problem. But what I'd say here is at least the stability of the state is the same. It's the same problem as the stability of the spin liquid on the honeycomb. Another thing is, besides the instantons, just because we have a gapless U1 gauge theory, worry about fluctuations in this gauge theory, gauge field affecting your one-dimensional edge modes and perhaps opening up a gap. Here we use the result from 1+1 dimensional QED that says that if you have gapless fermions in one dimension, that they always open up a gap in the gauge field. And so our picture here is that although we have a gapless U1 gauge field in the bulk, that as you go to the edge, there's actually a gap opened up in the gauge field due to the presence of these edge states. And so that suppresses fluctuations and helps protect them. Finally, even though we don't have spin flip terms in our Hamiltonian, you might worry that such terms could be generated. at low energy. And in our model, since everything's local, the lowest order terms that would be generated would then be a local interaction between the layers for spin-flip interactions. And you know, if you look at this with a scaling argument, we can show that it's actually irrelevant as long as n is sufficiently large. N is 4 here, and k is a Langer parameter, so as long as that's not too far from 1, or weak scattering is not too strong. And here's, you know, this argument would definitely change if you had tunneling between the layers. So I think, again, this is in the context of our toy model that only had a Coulomb interaction between the layers.
On the second bullet, just to make sure I understand that. So so the instantons and all that, I mean, so the gauge flux is bound
so that's
spin or something?
Well, that's, you know, it's sort of related to these arguments we've been getting. You know, if you put a flux flowing through a plaquette, you know, for the filled lambda level, that would attract, either attract or repel a charge, right? So in our case, for the ordinary case, you would, say, sucks in a spin up and spits out a spin.
That's like
a spin one excitation, which wouldn't be allowed in our case.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is only one U1 field, not two U1 fields.
Yeah, well, and that's because we're solving this model near the special point of where U prime, the interaction between the layers, is 2U. So in fact, we only have an interaction that brings in N1 plus N2 at each site, where 1 and 2 is our layer indices. I mean, in general, you'd have two gauge fields and two charge modes, and it's just we haven't solved that, so we don't know what happens in that system.
In general, you would expect that there are two cases. In one case, there's U1 fields are locked to each other, and in the other case, they're independent, which means that vortices in each layer are conserved, something like that. Oh, no, sorry. U1 charges in each layer are conserved. Is it true? If you just look at the model itself, you know.
You mean with where we move away from this special point? Yes. So I haven't actually thought much about what happens. You know, I mean, of course, you can move away a certain amount, and you know, nothing really changes, but, you know, because it's a matter of energy scales. But if you really look at the problem with, you know, far away from that, where you have two independent gauge fields. Yeah, so what's the point you're worried about in that model? What?
I worry that there is another case which might be more stable. Maybe it's not an issue. But the other case has two independent U1 fields in
layers.
Right, right. You want gauge fields?
And I think that really probably does change things, and it probably actually affects many of these stability arguments, I guess, too, right? Because, you know, you have excitations now. I guess you're suggesting things happening with fluxes between the layers, and, or that would be equivalent to... Yeah. Anyways, I haven't thought about this in depth, but I'm sure that problem is quite different, and maybe one could argue even that it's not likely to be stable. I don't know. Have you thought about this, Sung-Sik?
As far as U prime is close to U.
Yeah, then you're fine. No, but he's wondering if you really move away from that, you have two independent gauge fields. Can you say anything about stability in that?
So this is open QD. You're saying that the 1 plus 1 d gap is formula will generate a theta term at the boundary? So you get the gap in the electromagnetic field you're talking about?
Actually, I'm just using a known result there. I guess this is Schwinger's work. Exactly.
That's about a 1D fermion coupled to a 1D gauge field.
Yep. Yes. Okay. Yeah. But everything's local here, right? It's
no. You have to just take the one dimension, couple the bulk, and you just the positive integral of the bulk gauge modes, you generate a linear gauge coupling as the boundary.
Okay.
but the mass term is still coming as a linear portion, you know, the linear Q behavior of the gate field as the boundary too. So so the gap will, I mean, the mass term will always dominate as the boundary field.
Okay, so Leon asked us to say something about future directions. So these are not things that we've worked on, but I'll just throw them out here. One thing is, you know, since in this space the chargeons are gapped, that means that one, we could have worked with a spin model without any charge degrees of freedom to study this phase. And if you look at our particular model for large U, you can derive the effective low-energy Hamiltonian, and so this would be the spin model corresponding to our model, where this term is like a, you know, it's playing the role of the S psi dot Sj term, except here these omegas are 4x4 matrices because we have layer indexes as well as the spin index, and then you get the additional term from the second paper hopping. And so, you know, presumably one, you know, might be able to go beyond mean field theory, perhaps do some numerical studies, and also, you know, with such a model, you can imagine doing the things that you do for the spin liquids, where you add higher order ring exchanges to help stabilize the fractionalization. Another avenue is, you know, for us, you know, working with a U1 gauge theory, it was absolutely essential to have this other bilayer or the extra flavor there, so that you can have both phenomena and yet have stability in both phenomena. This makes one think that, you know, you could avoid these problems of needing the bilayer if you could do this with an icing or a Z2. Spin liquid where both the charge and the spin degrees of freedom are gapped. I think the problem there is thinking how in the current theories of our Z2 spin liquid, how you'd actually introduce this kind of spin orbit coupling to the fermions. And finally, obviously, you know, one would like to think of more realistic models, perhaps. You know, such insights can be gained from studying the effective spin model, or another avenue is to generalize this to three dimensions where fractionalization is actually more stable, but of course then also all your competing broken symmetry orders are also more stable.
More questions?
So one question I have is, this does not satisfy the many-body definition that you and Kang would have. There is no, when you thread a flux, there's no motion of charge or spins.
No, well here, no, this is, you mean their definition of real fractionalization? I'd say, you know, this, you know, the spin-ons, you know.
No, but I'm not talking about the definition of fractionalization, but whether this is actually a spin, many-body spin-ball effect. Because when you thread the flux, you don't have any motion of the spin-ons, because it's a, this is the U1. The U1 doesn't couple the spin-ons.
Yeah, but so I don't know what you're, so you, what definition is, doesn't it satisfy?
Well, so my question is, I mean, so I know that there is another definition of the many-body quantum spin-Hall effect, which is due to Sum-Sig. So do you think that this satisfies that one, or, because it doesn't seem to.
So, first of all, this is gapless in the ball.
Okay,
so yeah, it's tricky to define.
I think you may want to be careful about this, where the spin-ons don't couple to the external flux through the cylinder, because yes. Notice that this phase is stable only near metal insulator transition.
Yes.
So there's a lot of charge fluctuation. In fact, that's the reason why this state can be stabilized by introducing like ring exchange terms, etc., etc. So the fact that you need to use a virtual charge fluctuations to generate a ring exchange term suggests that prismally external flux may couple to charge fluctuations, and that virtual charge fluctuation may give you some coupling to the external flux. So I'm not convinced that, you know, spin-ons wouldn't see the flux at all, especially given that
it's finite.
Yeah, but look at the ring exchange term. For example, you know,
So you're saying that, well, that would be destroying the charge-on gap, right?
No, you don't have to destroy the charge-on gap. Charge-on gap can be finite, but still, you know, wind change, we do see that. For example, you know, there was this work by, you know, Lessig Maturnich. Basically, he studied the ring change model under external field, and it ring change term does couple to the external accelerator potential. So
I think the point is that internal gauge field
is
precisely concerned at zero temperature.
It's true, but
in the large enough system, in the cylinder is large enough,
and the flux,
internal gauge flux that goes through the cylinder is conserved, precisely conserved.
But if you apply it externally, then you can induce some gauge
flux. Well, there is a response from the, you know, internal gauge flux reacts to the external field.
Well, you cannot, if the gauge flux is, external gauge field is really slow enough compared to the charge gap, then the internal gauge flux cannot.
You can prove that when you thread a flux and if it's a multi iterator, nothing is moving, then cannot have any. Also, if the argument is true, then I would expect that you can have the other way around. And when you thread a spin flux, you will pump a charge, but that's not possible when you have a charge gap.
No, we are talking about this specific phase, this U1 spinometric close to the metal insulator transition, right? So, you know, thinking about deriving spin model, right, starting from the Hubbard model, now what you do is you're just basically using a virtual charge fluctuations to derive the ring spin problem, right? So you go back to the Hubbard model, then thinking about how you have to modify your Hamiltonian, when there is external vector potential, right? So you have to modulate your kinetic energy, right? This is the Pyle substitution. They use that to derive the ring change model. You will see that there is a, you know, magnitude dependence.
I would still say, you know, in the thermodynamic limit, you know, I mean, as you made your cylinder very long, I mean, you know, and you
ate, I mean, it has nothing to do with the thermodynamic limit at all. I mean, this is the way that, charge, you know, virtual charge fluctuation react to the external vector potential. It comes in to the flare.
If you insert a single electromagnetic flux, that's not enough.
Oh, it's a single flux.
You may have to insert many external flux. Then you can.
The difference is what some flux whose only influence is via the vector potential and has no actual magnetic field.
Oh, I see. Okay.
All right. Maybe this is a good point.
Okay, I agree.
Well, let's thank the speaker. Catherine's decoupling there, and the next talk comes in. That's sort of maybe a motivational question. Catherine, one more question for you.
Sure. Yep.
I'm going to take my prerogative as the chair. Now, if one's looking for combinations of kind of spin liquid physics with quantum spin ball, it almost seems a little funny to be looking in models in which you have no spin orbit interaction. I mean, why not consider compounds where there is substantial spin orbit coupling, but also interaction?
Yeah.
Some limit for small u, you know, you have some quantum spin Hall phase. For large u, you might have some magnet, and maybe in between, you hope to get some exotic ingredients.
Yeah, so I mean, and, you know, of course, this was a toy model, right? And you're thinking, you know, if we were actually modeling this on graphs, there's essentially no spin orbit interaction. That's what you're thinking.
Your model has no spin orbit interaction. So, no, I'm not thinking of graphs. I'm saying, let's imagine you took some.
Yeah, you want something with
some modulator that's got something heavy in it.
Yeah, but I mean, you also somehow, you know, you want to be near this. If you had such a system near a metal insulator transition, that would be a very interesting candidate, right? I guess the first problem is actually finding an example of a spin liquid, right?
Sure.
And my own personal view is that the ones that are near a metal insulator transition, I think, look somewhat more promising than the candidate for the power historic formula.
Frustration
in the general
statement. Okay. It's on.
Okay.
First of all, I would like to thank organizer for inviting me to this fantastic workshop and giving me to talk about some of our recent work. So today I want to go into talk about some the bulk edge relation in relation to the fractalization, and that can be understood as some the topological spin insulator with spin with strong interaction. So, on Monday, I talked a little bit with Charlie Kane, and I come to mind a little bit something related to this topic. So I want to make some comments on this one, and hopefully to do something. Okay. So the plan is that I want to first define some of the V2 type very basic. This is another V2, but that can be used for the kind of topological order parameter. And that can be applied to any dimension, but we need to do some numerical calculation, so the real calculation can be restricted to the maybe 1D and possibly small 2D system. And this can be understood by some bulk characterization. And one can do that something very similar with the system with edges. And that can be done for calculation of the entanglement entropy for the bulk system, but that related to the edge. And one can do the same thing. One can do something directly to discuss some quantum system with edges. And that also related to the fractionalization. And this fractionalization can be a keyword to understand these two phenomena. And as I said before, I want to make some comment about the time universal operator with the interaction, and hopefully to discuss something global to local. Okay. So the main idea is that there can be many quantum disorder systems in those dimensions, and that the property can be there are very strong quantum fluctuation and not symmetric breaking. So one cannot define a usual type of local order parameter, but still there are many phases. So we want to try to understand the difference of these kind of many quantum and gap system today. So I make some small list of the quantum gaps disorder system in condensed matter. The famous one can be the integer and fraction quantum for state, and diamond model of fermion and spin, and the integer spin chain, and balanced bond solid state. And some of the itinerant electron system can also belong to this kind of system. And the idea to discuss something, this kind of the topological disorder system is the topological order, discussed by Shannon, eh?
Sorry, what is dimer models of fermions?
Just think about a Sushi-Hakinga type model with the introduction. That can be a more simple scale. Hopping in dimer line.
Okay.
Yeah, that can be very simple, but that can be enough in the sense. So how to understand this gap to quantum leakage is a motivation. So the point is that for the bulk, classically, that bulk with this gap to quantum leakage is featureless. So the point is that we need some geometrical phase that is quantum nature. And the most typical example is the Chern number for the quantum Hall effect. And if the system has edges, there is a characteristic low energy mode within the energy gap. This is a main body gap. And that can be understood by edge state of quantum Hall effect, discussed by Laplace and Halperin. And there's some strong relation bulk and edge in between. And that can be summarized as a bulk edge correspondence. And this seems to be a very common feature of the topological order phase. So bulk and edges are related, and bulk characterize the edge state, and edge state again characterize the bulk property. So today I want to talk about this principle to apply some quantum spin system. The point is to define some D2 type very phases for the topological order spin system. And I want to try to discuss some edge state of the quantum spin system. That was first discussed by Kennedy in the Hausdorff spin case. Okay, the main idea is from this idea of the Anderson RBD. The point is that if one think about the quantum spin system in 2D, so the main point is that what is important is quantum spin is not a real spin. What can be important is a singlet pair. Well, the point of the singlet pair idea, it makes anyway a singlet, so thing disappears. But singlet is very simple, but still, it's already a quantum mechanical. This is one point. And if I'm going back to the old polling idea with the attendant program like this, the point is that what can be very important is not a Fermi field. What can be important is covalent bond like this. And one has to make some resonance between this kind of thing. That was the point. So this covalent bond itself is also a quantum nature. So and here I want to make some comments about the two types of the observable in quantum mechanics I'm teaching. But the usual one is the classical observable. That is a unitary invariant. That means this observable is independent of the phase of the wave function. But in the quantum world, there's another type of the observable, like interference between two different quantum states, like this. This is clearly not the unitary invariant one. But still, that can be observed in the quantum mechanical sense. So the typical one is the Ahanov-Bohm effect. And if I think in this way, the very phase, very connection, this kind of thing can be also belong to this kind of the observable. So this is fundamental quantum interference, and I want to try to use this kind of thing to characterize the quantum disorder phase. So the point is that I want to try to characterize the singlet pair using this very phase. The point is that singlet is spin zero, so singlet does not carry spin, but it carries a very phase pi. So that's the point. I want to explain a little bit. So the point is I want to apply this kind of the story to the generic high-level model, and I allow to have some frustration. The point is that the Hamiltonian should be given by this kind of S-locus type. The feature of this kind of thing is that this is time-reversal invariant. The point that is that the time-reversal operator makes this spin operator minus S, but here this is a product of two spins, so this is invariant, clearly. But the point of this kind of the many-body time-reversal operator is that the theta square crucially depends on the number of spins, or number of particles here. And mostly, what I want to try to show today is that the theta square could be one case. So if I think about this kind of the many-body effect in the real world for the condensed matter system, we have to care about this kind of thing, because in a probability one half, we have this kind of system. Okay. So the way to define the JD phase for the generic Heisenberg mode is this way. So just consider some, pick up some special bond here, and modify this kind of the exchange term to this way, just making some spin flip term to be a parameter dependent, only for some link. And this is periodic in theta, so if we define it in this way, one can define a many-body spin Hamiltonian depending on this parameter theta. So one can define a very phase using this many-body spin wave function and calculate this very phase. The point is that assuming the excitation gap and the time reversal invariance, one can show that this very phase cannot take any value. That can take only 2 by 0 or pi in mode 2 pi. So in this sense, this very phase defines some Z2 topological number for this time reversal invariant quantum system. Okay. So the point is that it's very simple, but I want to make some small summary for the very phase. So just think about the eigenvalue equation like this. Actually, I solved this kind of the main body Schrödinger equation by Dandruff method. Anyway, the point is that if one defines a very, very, very connection, like by a derivative of this wave function by some parameter like this, and one can define this very phase by integral. But the point is that this phase of the eigenvector is completely arbitrary. If one do some numerical calculation, that's clear. But the point is that if one assumes some the phase difference between two eigenvectors to be some continuous function into the omega like this, one can easily show that the vector potential for this original one and this guy is different by something like that. Then the very phase can obtain some extra factor like this. But assuming this epsilon factor to be a single value in parameter space, one can say that epsilon contribution is always 2 pi time integer. So this simple consideration shows that the very phase really depends on the phase. So that's not a classical observable. But in mode 2 pi, that's well defined. So one can use this very phase in mode 2 pi to do something numerically also. So the specialty of this time reversal generic anti-unitary operator is that if one applies this kind of the generic anti-unitary operator to some state like this, the point is that the very phase is very connection is actually purely imaginary. So applying this anti-unitary operator, the very phase gets minus sign here. This is also clear. But if one assumes the time reversal square to be 1 and the some state is invariant or unique round state like this, one can say that this theta psi to theta and the original one should be a gauge equivalent. So that means this very phase of this guy and the theta operator should be equivalent to mode 2 pi, but still it changes the sign here. So by this simple consideration, one can say that very phase for such a system should be allowed to have 2 values 0 pi in mode 2 pi. So that defines the D2 very phase. Okay. So this is a little bit technical one. But anyway, using some technical advantage, there's some technical advantage, but one can define, one can calculate very phase quite easily. So let's think a little bit about this kind of the very phase, D2 very phase by a Debye continuation that is here. So let's consider some of the collection of the single pair, decoupled single pair. And this one calculates very fast for a single spin pair. That's easy, but anyway, one can get very fast pi. And if I do some spin twist for nothing here, of course nothing occurs, so very fast for twisting this part is zero. So one can clearly see that very fast should be a zero pi, zero, pi, zero pi, zero pi, zero, something like that. But if one includes some finite spin interaction between these decoupled single pairs, if the energy, assuming that the energy gap, many body spin gap persists, one can say that the very phase for this part should be zero, because this is quantized, so this zero cannot continue to move some other value. So that continues to the some gap loading point. In this spin one half case, that's the uniform Heisenberg model point. So the point I want to point out here is that the this kind of adiabatic continuation for the gap system have some important physical meaning, like renormalization group argument for gap system. Okay. So this is some numerical result for the Heisenberg spin chain. This is trivial, but anyway, if one do some real calculation using a Lanczos method, one can obtain the for diamondized spin chain, pi zero, pi zero. This is clear. And for the another case, that's also clear, zero pi, zero pi, zero pi. For these two, that is a clear case, but if one do some ferromagnetic coupling between the anti-ferromagnetic singlets, one needs a real calculation. But if I do some numerical calculation, the very phase by twisting this unferromagnetic part, one can get pi. But if one do the same thing for the ferromagnetic bond, nothing occurs. The very phase is zero. So one can get a very phase zero pattern, zero pi, zero pi, zero pi. And one can, this is a kind of famous model to obtain the hardened spin chain by making a strong coupling ferromagnetic coupling. So one can naively expect that the very phase for the hardened spin chain, that the spin one system to be a uniform pi like this. And that really happened if one do a numerical calculation for the hardened case. But if one puts some additional term like this, and that's known that there's some Cartan phase transition for the from hardened phase to called the large D phase. And in the large D phase, if I do some numerical calculation, one can get the trivial very phase like this. So using this kind of the very phase as a local order parameter, one can define, one can capture this transition between D and D. Okay, this is simple. But if one do the same thing for a higher spin case, for example, for S equal 1 and 2, like this, and consider some diamondization in this 1D system like this, and parameterize this ratio by some cosine or sine like this, and plot some phase diagram on the line. So if this ratio between these two are something like this, then one can get very phase like that. And if one do change this ratio, then one can get very phase like this. And if one change again, there is some another very phase pattern occurs. This is for spin 1 case. And if we do the same thing for spin 2 case, one can get something similar for some region, and one can get another very phase pattern, and also. And like this. So in this spin 1 case, there are two phase, quantum phase transition, and for F equal 2 case, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 quantum phase transition. And that can be captured by this very phase. So the point is that this very phase is translation invariant. So this is not like in a usual sense, not a binary among solids, but okay. So, but one can have some kind of the valence bond interpretation for this result using this famous affect type valence bond picture like this. So the numerical result of the very phase show that this kind of the quantum phase transition is really understood by a reconstruction of this kind of valence bond for this higher spin case. And if I do the same thing for the higher S with theta, one can get a similar quantum phase transition. This can be also understood by deconstruction bias mode. And the one can do something a little bit analytically for the generic as the valence bond solid type AKLP type model. It's a little bit complicated, but point is that the very phase for this higher S model is also given by pi times some number of valence bonds. So it clearly shows that the very phase counts the number of valence bonds, even for the spin 1 and 2 case. And valence bond is defined by a spin 1 half object. So I want to say that the result suggests the spin 1 half object is really fundamental. So original one is spin 1 and 2, so one can say that this can be a fractionalization. Okay, this is a fractionalization for the bulk part. And if one do something similar, using entanglement entropy for a system with it to discuss some edge set, one can get a very similar fractionalization again. But before going into the entanglement entropy part, one can do the same very fast calculation even for 2D or radars if the system is small. But I don't want to go into details today. Yeah. So next, I want to a little bit talk about the edge set of this kind of quantum spin using entanglement entropy or direct fractionation of the spectrum. This can be very easy, but anyway. So it may not be necessary to explain entanglement entropy, but the point is that let's first consider some quantum mechanical state, so that's making the pure state dense matrix and stress over one of them. Then one can get generically mixed state. Then entropy of this mixed state gives the entanglement entropy. That gives the correlation between two, A and B, special correlation between these two. So naively, if one assumes we consider some pressing out for one of them, can make some edge states. One can say that one can naively expect that entanglement entropy has something very crucial contribution from edge state. So the point is that using this kind of the entanglement entropy, one can get some information about the edge state. That's the point. So one can do exact calculation using this kind of the valence bond solid type wave function for higher S. And for generic spin S case, one can get entanglement entropy like that. So that suggests that there is some the edge state with spin S half. But in the case of the spin 1, then we have some effective boundary spin with S1 half. That was first discussed by Kennedy, and after that, that was given experimentally confirmed. That's called Kennedy triplet. And one can do this, something very similar with this kind of ring exchange radar model. But I don't want to go into detail, but the point is that, so using there are some several phases with gap and vector chirality phase or something, but one can do, if one do some explicit diagonalization with edges, one can observe some kind of the Kennedy triplet like low energy state between inside the many body gap. And the point is that this in gap state is from this, the contribution of this effective interaction between boundary spin, and that depends on system size by exponentially, and one can get some information for this boundary spin. That was first discussed by Kennedy and experimental observer. Okay, the message from which we learn is that the, there is a strong bulk and edge relation correspondence even for spin. And the, as I assume that this time reversal to square is 1 as for totally, but the, one can get some the boundary in equilibrium like that. And the, one can understand this way. One can get some boundary in equilibrium from left and right. And this is S1 half object. So if one restricts this low energy sector, the time reversal operator can be given by a product of the left time reversal spin and time reversal over right spin, like this. And the, each of them satisfies its usual odd number of particle time reversal constraints, like this usual one, one particle type thing. So, and if one focuses only for this one side of the physics of this one boundary, it's not necessary to care about another one. So one can get kind of the super selection loop for one boundary. So if one do this way, so one can define some global time reversal to local boundary, local time reversal using this kind of gate, edge set picture. So if one do something similar for 3D, I hope to get something time reversal for the surface phase. But to do this, I need to do something 3D calculation. So that can be an interesting topic, but I couldn't do that. See you now. So thank you.
Questions?
Yeah.
It seems that the, for the 1D, if you have spin one half chain, then, then the topological environment you define is so it's like pi on this bond and zero.
Yeah.
But for interchain, if it's pi on this bond, it seems always pi on the net.
Yeah.
So is that the key and that general for integer spin chain? I mean. So
For the integer spin chain, one has to, the very first pattern should be always uniform if the coupling is nearest neighbor.
So it's general for any spin integer model.
Yeah, but the but if the coupling is with next to nearest neighbor, that's not clear. Oh. For the simple nearest neighbor spin chain, the very first pattern should be always uniform. One can show that by a gauge invariant argument. Otherwise, yes. But spin one half or spin all the integer case, that's always alternating. But if the interaction is with next to near neighbor, then that's not clear. Like a marginal type. That's not the thing. And 2D, that's not clear at all.
Will you consider higher speed spin chain?
Yes.
You have different phases actually for same V2, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then can you have some other topological
Up to now, no. I can, using this query, one cannot distinguish, but that can be interesting, but if one can do that.
The point is, whether you are able to construct a different
and then that can be interesting.
From these reconstructions, we can see actually they are different.
Yeah.
Is there a way to decompose your time reversal operator into a product of three things? Did you get like
bounding?
I mean, not that necessarily bounding, but a way to decompose it to a product of three things instead of a product of two things?
But that determined by number of spin, actually. That's a real time reversal operator. So.
Like, is there a way to do it so that you get something like 1 e to the 2 pi over 3, e to the 4 pi over 3, instead of these 2 minus 1s?
So according to my
understanding. So now you have left and right edges, you're both minus
one. Yeah, that's effective. So, yeah, it depends on the spectrum which you send. So, yeah, it depends. We may have more boundaries there, and one has to be clever enough to make some low energy effective. Yeah, but